Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
They say justice is blind, but in Lector County, Kentucky, it was shot dead in cold blood. September 19th of 2024 is what we're talking about. A Thursday morning like any other. Until it wasn't, inside the Lector County Courthouse. What happened? Judge Kevin Mullen sat behind his desk going about his usual routine. Just before 10 a.m., Sheriff Sean Mickey Steins walked into his chambers, change the course of history. Without warning, he pulled out a handgun and fired. The first shot was enough to put Mullins down. The next few were just to make sure. Surveillance cameras caught it all. No sound, just the cold, clinical footage of a man executing a sitting judge. And here's where things get strange. After making absolutely sure the judge was dead, Steins didn't flee. He didn't fight. He calmly walked to the nearest deputy, handed over his gun, and surrendered without a struggle, almost like he had just checked off an errand on his to-do list. Get up this morning, take the dogs out, drive the kids to school, shoot the judge, get arrested, spend my life in prison. The courthouse went into lockdown. People were screaming. Staff barricaded themselves in offices. Within minutes, law enforcement flooded the scene, not as Steins' backup, but to take their own sheriff into custody. Imagine the confusion in that building. When the man that you're hunting down, the man that you otherwise would be going to for help in a situation just like this, is the one causing the chaos. And just like that, the man elected to uphold the law became the county's most infamous murder suspect.
He
was initially charged with first-degree murder. The prosecution wasted absolutely no time on that, pushing for no bond, and the judge agreed. Stein's, he wasn't going anywhere. There was no excuse that was going to come out that was going to make that change. He entered an initial plea of not guilty, setting the stage for one of the most bizarre legal battles in Kentucky ever. Because here's the thing. This wasn't just any murder. This was a sheriff killing a judge inside the courthouse, the place where law is supposed to reign supreme. You don't get much more high profile than that. And yet, from the moment Sheriff Steins turned himself in, one question lingered in the air. Why? Why did the sheriff shoot the judge? What is going on here? They were friends. That one time they were actually family. Like, by in-law. It didn't take long for his attorney, Jeremy Bartley, to offer up a theory. Steins wasn't in his right mind. Okay, but why? At first, the defense hinted at an extreme emotional disturbance. The idea was that Steins had snapped in the moment. Something had pushed him over the edge. But as the weeks went on, Bartley changed tactics. This wasn't just about a bad temper or overwhelming stress. This was full-blown insanity. That's where we're at now. Enter California encephalitis, a rare neurological condition that Steins' legal team claims affected his brain function under extreme stress. Sounds like a mouthful, right? Basically, it's a viral brain infection that may cause confusion, memory issues, and in rare cases, aggression. It's a kind of thing that, if severe enough, could make someone lose control. That's the argument. But convincing a jury that Steins didn't know what he was doing, that's an entirely different battle. See, Kentucky's insanity defense law isn't easy to navigate. It follows a version of the McNaughton rule, which means Steins has to prove that at the time of the murder, he either, one, didn't understand what he was doing, or two, couldn't tell right from wrong. That's a high bar to clear. And juries don't like letting accused murderers off the hook. They're not good at that. In Kentucky, insanity defenses are about as rare as a unicorn sighting. Most people don't buy it, and they don't attempt it either. That's where the psychiatric experts come in. The defense will need professionals to argue that Steins was mentally incapacitated when he pulled the trigger. And you better believe the prosecution will have their own experts, too. Ones who will say he was fully aware and acted with intent. Because here's something to think about. If Steins was truly out of his mind, why did he calmly surrender? Why not flee? Why not resist? Those are the kind of questions that the prosecution is going to be hammering home. And the stakes, they're huge. If the insanity defense works, Steins won't be sent to prison. Instead, he'll be committed to a secure psychiatric facility where he'd remain until doctors decide he's no longer a danger. That could mean life in a mental hospital, or it could mean an eventual release. If it fails, he's looking at a straight-up murder conviction, which in Kentucky means life in prison, possibly without parole, or worse, the death penalty, if the prosecution chooses to seek it. So yeah, the case, it is just getting started. Now here's where things get even messier, because it's not as black and white as what we just talked about. You're thinking, why would a respected sheriff suddenly decide to execute a judge? It's a good question. Well, there is more to the story. A lot more to the story. 3 days before the shooting, Sean Steins sat for a deposition in a federal lawsuit. A lawsuit that tied directly back to Judge Kevin Mullins. This wasn't just any lawsuit. It was one that exposed a sex scandal inside Mullen's own courthouse. Kind of big stuff. If you're wondering how that fits into all of this, buckle up, because that's a whole different level of corruption that we may be talking about here. Kevin Mullins was the kind of judge who made you wonder whether the courtroom was a place of justice or just another extension of a small town political boys club. For years, he had been a fixture in Lector County, wearing a black robe like a man who believed he owned the law rather than served it. His career followed the classic Appalachian power playbook. Local boy rises through the ranks, makes the right friends, wins the election, and suddenly he's the one calling the shots. Mullins had been on the bench long enough to build influence, but not long enough to be completely untouchable. On the surface, he played the role well, polished, respected, the kind of judge who knew everyone in town by name, who shook hands at football games, who could chat it up in a room full of lawyers and coal miners with equal ease. But just beneath that thin layer of professionalism, that's where the real story lived, allegedly. In a county where political alliances mean everything, Mullins had built his share of them. He was close with law enforcement, especially Sheriff Steins. The two had worked side by side for years, running the courthouse like their own little kingdom. If Mullins made a ruling that benefited Steins' department, nobody batted an eye. If Steins' deputies gave Mullins' courtroom extra attention, nobody questioned it. It was just how things are done. That's what we do here. And people knew better than to cross him. Mullins wasn't the kind of judge you wanted to challenge. If you were a lawyer, your cases might suddenly start going sideways. If you were a defendant, your sentence might get a little longer than expected. There were rumors. There are always rumors. But in Lector County, what mattered wasn't whether they were true. It was whether you were willing to risk finding out. But in 2022, the cracks started to show. That was the year a federal lawsuit landed on Mullins' doorstep, one that threatened to pull back the curtain on his courtroom. And what it alleged was nothing short of a nuclear bomb. The lawsuit told a story that sounded more like something out of a crime show than real life. A female defendant caught up in a house arrest sentence claimed she had been sexually coerced inside Mullins' own chambers, not by the judge himself, but by a deputy working under his authority. Her testimony painted a grim picture. According to her, the deputy, who also served as Mullins' bailiff, made it clear that her freedom depended on one thing: her willingness to trade sex for special treatment. If she complied, she stayed out of jail. If she refused, she risked being thrown back behind bars on a technicality. And it wasn't just her. Another woman came forward with a similar story, claiming she had been manipulated into sexual favors in exchange for leniency. Both described the courthouse system that wasn't just broken, it was actively working against vulnerable people trapped inside it. And where was Mullins in all of this? That's the million-dollar question. The lawsuit didn't directly accuse the judge of participating in the abuse, but it didn't clear him either. It claimed that this was happening inside his own chambers, a place where he held absolute control. The victim said the deputy operated freely because he knew nobody was watching. No security cameras, no oversight, just the assumption that the powerful didn't get questioned. For his part, Mullins never publicly addressed the allegations before his death. But legally speaking, silence isn't the same as innocence. And the lawsuit didn't just go after the bailiff. It went after Sheriff Steins himself. According to the case, Steins either knew about the abuse and ignored it, or he was so incompetent that he let it happen right under his nose. Either way, it meant one thing: he was just as responsible. The lawsuit argued that Steins failed to properly train or supervise his deputies, creating an environment where coercion and abuse could thrive. It was a damning accusation and put both men, Mullins and Steins, under a microscope. But legal cases move slowly. And in small-town politics, the goal is always to outlast the scandal. You can survive the headlines, people will move on. Something else will come up to gate their attention. That might have been the plan. But then, in September of 24, the deposition happened. 3 days before the shooting, Stein sat down for questioning in the lawsuit, and for several hours, he had to answer for everything. We know exactly what was said. The transcript hasn't been made public. But what we do know is that whatever came up in that room, it was enough to shake the sheriff. Because that deposition, that was the first time Steins had to go on the record about the corruption allegations tied to his office. The first time he was forced to face details, the victims, the accusers, the choices that led him to that seat. And more importantly, it might have been the first time he had to speak about Mullen's role in all of it. Did Steins implicate the judge? Did he throw him under the bus to protect himself? Did he say something that he knew he couldn't take back? Those are the questions that loom over this case, because just 3 days later, Steins walked into Mullen's chambers and shot him dead. That's what makes this whole thing much bigger than a murder. It's not just about a sheriff losing control. It's about why he lost control. And the closer you look at that deposition, the more it starts to feel like a turning point. Maybe it was the moment. The moment Steins realized he was going down. Or maybe, just maybe, it was the moment he decided he wasn't going down alone. The legal system in Kentucky was never designed to handle a case like this. A sitting sheriff walks into a courthouse, guns down a judge, and now that same system, the one both men once controlled, is responsible for deciding what happens next? The conflict of interests are obvious from day one, but what are they going to do? Well, that's why the local judicial system had to step aside almost immediately. A special judge from outside the region has been assigned to oversee the trial, along with a special appointed circuit clerk. Every move is being scrutinized because nobody wants this case to be thrown out on a technicality. The last thing the state wants is an appeal based on claims that Steins didn't get a fair trial. But let's be real, what does a fair trial even look like in a case like this? Finding an impartial jury? Well, that's going to be a nightmare. This isn't just another crime story. It's Letcher County history. People here knew Judge Mullins. They knew Sheriff Steins. Some worked with them. Some owed them favors. Others had grudges. That alone makes it almost impossible to seat a jury that isn't walking in with some kind of bias. There's already talk of a change of venue, which means the trial could be moved to a different county to find jurors who weren't living under the weight of Mullins and Stein's political influence. But even then, the case has made national headlines. Any juror in Kentucky has likely already heard some version of the story. The real question is whether they can find 12 people who are willing to listen to the evidence instead of the rumors. And that's not the only hurdle here, because Stein's legal team is about to take a massive gamble. They want Mullen's alleged past dragged into the courtroom. Stein's defense is preparing to argue that Mullen's connection to the courthouse sex scandal is directly relevant to why the murder happened. They want the jury to hear about the alleged abuse in his chambers, the lawsuit, the victims, the coercion, all of it. Their argument? That Steins, well, he was mentally unraveling under the weight of the deposition. And that Mullins wasn't just a victim, he was part of a larger corrupt system that had finally come crashing down on itself. Maybe he's the hero in this. Maybe this is vigilante justice. He took out a predator. Maybe. He still can't do that. The prosecution, on the other hand, is going to fight that with everything they have, because here's the reality. A murder trial isn't supposed to be about the victim's reputation. Legally speaking, whether Mullins was involved in the scandal or not does not change what happened on September 19th of 2024. Steins walked into the chambers, pulled the gun, fired multiple rounds. The judge will have to decide whether evidence about Mullen's misconduct is relevant or it's just a distraction. If they allow it, the trial could turn into a referendum on the courthouse corruption instead of a straight murder case. If they block it, the defense will argue that Stein's side of the story is being suppressed. Either way, it's going to be a legal fight that could shape the entire direction of the trial. And hanging all over this whole mess, the death penalty. So far, prosecutors haven't said whether they're going to seek it. It's not an automatic decision. Seeking the death penalty means a longer, more expensive trial and an extra phase of sentencing. And a jury has to be death qualified, which means anyone who is morally opposed to the death penalty is automatically excluded. So if you want to get out of jury duty and you know it's a death penalty case, just say that. Or that you listen to a lot of true crime. That kind of jury tends to favor the prosecution, which might be exactly why they might decide to go for it. But there's also politics involved. If they don't seek the death penalty, some in the community will see it as a weak move, like the system protecting its own. If they do go down it, it turns Steins into something bigger than just a defendant. He's become a man fighting for his life. Juries tend to hesitate when the ultimate punishment is on the table. The decision here will shape everything about how this trial plays out. The insanity defense is already a long shot, and if it fails, Stein's legal team is going to need backup plans. Because pleading not guilty is not going to cut it, especially when you're on camera doing it. One plausible fallback, diminished capacity. This isn't quite the same as insanity. It's more like arguing that Steins wasn't thinking clearly when he pulled the trigger. But he wasn't legally insane either. The goal here would be to push for a lesser charge, like manslaughter instead of murder. And if the defense can convince a jury that Steins acted under extreme emotional disturbance, the punishment could be reduced significantly. But let's be honest. The prosecution isn't going to let that argument slide without a fight. They're going to paint Steins as a calculated killer, a man who knew exactly what he was doing and had a reason for doing it. Their argument is straightforward. If Steins truly snapped, why did he bring a gun into the courthouse? Well, because he's the sheriff. Why did he immediately surrender instead of running or resisting? And that looks a lot more like a planned execution than a temporary mental breakdown. That's exactly what the jury is going to have to decide. If the insanity plea doesn't work, the jury doesn't buy the diminished capacity argument, Steins is looking at the full weight of a murder conviction. That could mean life without parole, or if prosecutors do go for it, a death sentence. There's also the possibility of a plea deal, but don't expect Steins to take one unless the offer is significantly better than the risk of trial. Given the brutality of the crime and the public outrage, prosecutors aren't likely to offer much leniency. The reality is this case is going to trial, and it's going to be one hell of a fight. But this isn't just about Steins anymore, because when you take a step back, this case isn't just about one murder. It's about an entire system that let this happen. For years, Mullins and Steins ran the courthouse like their own personal empire. The power structure in Lector County, it protected them, insulated them, let them away, get away with things that, you know, should have raised some alarms a long time ago. When that system finally started to collapse, it collapsed in the most violent way possible. And the real question is, what else is going to come out before this trial is over? Because if this case exposes more corruption, more abuses, more unchecked power, this might not just be about the judge and one sheriff. This might just be about the beginning of a much, much bigger case against many, many officials in that county. There's a lot more to this. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, joining us to discuss the new elements of this case. The extreme emotional disturbance argument that was initially was talked about, now we're going flat out to full insanity. Is this going to hold up with the potential underlying motives that aren't being openly talked about yet? Could Stein's actions be linked to the courthouse scandal? And if so, could that complicate this whole mental health defense that they're talking about?
I think it absolutely could compromise that defense because, you know, part of an insanity defense is saying, I didn't know right from wrong. But what it seems like is that Sheriff Steins knew something very wrong was happening, and he took what he thought was righteous action in order to stop that. That's kind of the definition of knowing right and wrong, at least in one's own mind. And then this extreme emotional disturbance thing, that's kind of gone by the wayside. That's usually not its own defense, and courts often don't even allow that in terms of trying to disprove charges. And so I think defense is going to have some problems with this one.
You know, a lot of people are looking at this as, you know, I think we want to believe there's a hero in a case that involves accusations of sexual assault. You want to believe somebody's did something for the right reasons. I mean, it's never right to just go shoot somebody. But, you know, one could see it being justified, especially with a phone call, especially with his daughters being called right before this occurred. That is all such weird elements of this case. And we just don't know the answer to those questions as of yet. But could this be, you know, not so up and up, where maybe he's not the hero that everybody kind of wants him to be? He was pretty tight with the judge. He did do that deposition just days before. There could be a very real chance that he's implicated in the charges against the judge that were out there, that he had something to do with it. I mean, we're talking about his deputy that is accused of the assault in the chambers, and that he didn't discipline, didn't train properly, didn't monitor this situation enough and allowed it basically to happen on his watch. It makes me wonder if there's something here where did he kill the judge because the judge was going to expose him further?
You know, there is some ominous revelations that are coming out, and they're all allegations. This case is very early on, and we don't know exactly what occurred. But if this judge was involved in some sort of sex for leniency prospect and the sheriff also had some involvement, certainly that is damning information no one would want the public to receive. And it's not unprecedented for an affiliate or someone involved in some web like what could have been going on to try to silence other folks so that they're protecting, you know, their own butt.
I mean, these are two completely separate cases, at least they were, until all of this went down. There was the case that was pointing at the judge, but Steins is part of it. And then there's this, which happened and started 3 days after that deposition. Are we going to see things merge here together? Are we going to see the federal case where they're looking at the judge? I mean, is there discovery to be found over there that could help understand or explain what happened? Or are these two really still separate entities that don't have a lot to do with one another? Or would we ever find out? Because we're talking about court cases, filings, things that are going to be under seal and such.
In the criminal context, there's a concept called res gestae. And essentially what it means is that, generally speaking, the jury is entitled to hear the background, the context, if it helps inform their understanding of the specific allegations. And so I think surely this outside information that may have contributed to the alleged crime is relevant. I think a jury is going to hear about it. And I think that the cases are going to pick from one another in terms of getting helpful information from the civil side, bringing on witnesses from the criminal side into the civil case. Those things are going to begin to mesh, in my opinion.
Insanity being the new thing that's being brought up here. I mean, we don't know if that will be allowed into court to be argued. The prosecution is conducting their own psychiatric evaluation. What are they going to need to prove in order to bring that into court?
Really, a pillar of insanity is that the defendant could not tell right from wrong, due to some mental disease or defect. So that predicate mental health piece has to be established, and it's established through those evaluations you just mentioned. Now, usually what happens is the prosecutor does an evaluation and says, this guy's fine. There's no mental health disease or there's no mental disease or defect. Then the defense does their own, and the defense expert says, oh, yes, there is. And then usually that is enough to meet the threshold, so long as you have one expert saying there is a mental disease or defect that contributed to the person's inability to understand right from wrong.
Would you have to show a pattern of that to be valid, that there was other issues in the past, not just suddenly out of nowhere he snaps and kills this guy? I mean, if you're truly, you know, insane, if you have, you know, if you're suffering from, you know, if you're a psychopath, if you're a sociopath, that's not just something like, boom, it comes on. It's there for a long period of time. Is that going to be a really hard one to argue, you think?
I think so. Something you're touching on is this sort of colloquial notion of temporary insanity. And I get so many clients who come to me and they're like, hey, what about temporary insanity? That's not really a thing.
No.
in most courts. Usually with insanity, like you said, there has to be some buildup. There has to be some psychological vulnerability to completely snapping and losing your cool. It's usually not just someone who has been reasonably fine, psychologically intact for their entire lives. Then something bad happens and they act out. That's not a defense, and that's not insanity.
No, it's not. Let's play the other side of this, though. What if he did find out something really horrible and shocking? Let's say that there is a lot of legitimacy to the accusations about the judges' chambers basically being used as a brothel. And, you know, the sheriff's like shocked by this. Again, as close as they were, I don't know how he would be shocked by this, but let's say he's shocked by this. And let's say he finds out in some way, shape, or form his daughter or a friend or somebody close to him, young, has been victimized by this said brothel. If you're a parent and you're getting that information and you have a weapon on you and the person who's alleged to be doing these things, or you find out that, you know, maybe they are, one could understand. One would pull a weapon and shoot the other. Is that insanity? Or is that, you know, what would that be looked at if in fact it goes that way?
Yes, so it's still within the mental health realm, but it's likely not insanity. It's much more likely what's called heat of passion. And so heat of passion is usually when a person receives such overly distressing information that a reasonable person could not have contained themselves, that they would have it would have been irresistible impulse for them to act out. That's more heat of passion. The thing about heat of passion, though, is it's not a complete defense. It doesn't result in a person being found not guilty. It can lessen the severity of the charge, lessen the severity of the penalty, but it's not a complete out for Sheriff Steins.
Does Steins' willingness to surrender in this case, like right after it happened, he just walks out, puts a gun down, arrest me. That doesn't seem to me, at least, and I'm not a psychologist, but it doesn't seem to be how an insane person would be functioning. If you're out of control and you're just, you shot him, and you would think you'd be running, not like, well, here you go, I'm done. Or maybe that is insane. Maybe it is insane to go, here, take me.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, I would expect perhaps someone who was actually insane to, like, you know, run out and rip off all their clothes and saying aliens are eating my brain or something like that.
Yeah.
But when we have with the action that Sheriff Stein took, it seemed like he kind of knows what he did. He knows at least the legal wrongfulness of his alleged conduct, and he's willing to kind of surrender to that, in part because he's in law enforcement and is taught to be cooperative in that context. And so that seems a lot more like someone who knows what they were doing and is going through the motions that they kind of expect to be going through after that.
I'm just going to throw this out there because we've seen it in other cases where there's a member of law enforcement that is in question. And there's obviously more than one person in law enforcement in a community, at least in most. And there certainly is here, albeit a small community. If there's others that were involved in this alleged, you know, brothel thing that's going on, you know, we already have the, you know, one of the people under the sheriff here that's, you know, been, you know, taken away for it. One might think there might be more people involved. Who's investigating this? Who's looking into this? Because if you start digging into the evidence and you start looking at discovery and you start looking at the text messages and the phone calls and the communications in general over all of this stuff, there might be some people who don't want their name intermingled with it that have nothing to do with the murder, but more so over here on the sex side. I would be a little bit concerned about getting, you know, the full picture of evidence in this if there's other names that you know, I don't want to be mixed up in this, even though I am, because you just kind of be exposed by default, would you not?
Yeah, Tony, that is a very real concern. You know, look, the sheriff's office for which Sheriff Steins works should not be investigating itself. That there's just too much of a likelihood of bias in favor of the suspect with whom they work. They know them. They might have like gone to dinner with their family, stuff like that. And so usually what happens is an outside law enforcement entity should be appointed to do the investigation. An entity that is impartial, that is unbiased, that doesn't know Sheriff Steins. And that has less of a likelihood of, you know, compromising the investigation and giving someone favor when they shouldn't. And so that is what should happen. And in fact, a special prosecutor outside of the jurisdiction should also be assigned to oversee that investigation.
And I know we have that. I know there's a special prosecutor. I know there's a judge that's going to be seeing this from out of the jurisdiction. It's just that and I don't know the answer to that. And I'm not accusing anyone of that. It's just something that comes to mind when we see a case like this, because we've seen other law enforcement agencies cover up for themselves, that people have nothing to do with the case. They just don't want their names getting out there and their skeletons to come out of the closet, which would inevitably be when you shake the snow globe around, there they go too. I don't know. It makes me wonder. I'm not accusing anyone, but it's certainly something that I think an eye should be placed on when we see what comes out here. Because I'm sure there's going to be a lot that is going to be revealed in this community that not a lot of people are going to want to. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, joining us from a clinical standpoint. What does it take for someone to reach a psychological breaking point like this and commit such an extreme act? And do these extreme emotional responses happen instantly, or is this something that, you know, maybe built up over time a bit in a case like this?
Boy, this is a guy I would love to sit down and talk to and get a sense for him. It's so hard to know. Extreme emotional disturbance, which is what they're claiming here, isn't a clinical diagnosis. You don't find it in our diagnostic manual. So it's a legal term that you find in just a handful of states. Not all states even use it. Apparently they do there. So what does it mean? Usually it's alluding to the kind of event, the thing that's always referenced is walking in on your wife in bed with another man and picking up a gun and shooting him because you're just so upset. Mm-hmm. So it implies that you're not mentally ill, you're just a regular person, but you're so distraught by something that any of us can relate to that you lose control in that situation. So it implies that it's not premeditated. But when they throw in insanity, that would imply something completely different, that there is a pre-existing mental health condition of some sort. We hear no evidence about that. So unless there's a lot of, you know, other things that are just not being discussed at this point, it's really hard to say.
And there's so much of this case that we don't know about yet. We don't know what was on that phone. We don't know why he said they're going to get my family, why his daughter was called right before this took place, what happened in that deposition. There's so many unknowns. But yeah, to go to insanity, that seems like a bit of a leap, just from the extreme emotional, angle of this. Wouldn't you have to show like a pattern of behavior? Can insanity just come on? Are there moments that can truly be looked at like this? Or is it something it's kind of a gradual build or just kind of a continuum?
Most of the time it's a gradual build and a continuum, although there can be incidents of a psychotic condition could be related to a medication. Certainly, we know that people who use meth can have abrupt psychotic breaks with bizarre delusions. The sheriff doesn't strike me as a meth user, though. But was there something else, something in the environment that triggered a psychotic break and he became aggressive and violent? That's always possible, but we haven't heard any evidence of that. And it seems like it would have been something other people were noticing as well, at least, you know, within a few hours of this murder.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he's a sheriff and he's, you know, executing his job, I'm not trying to make a pun there, but he's doing his job, you know, as normal up until this point. I don't know where you're going to go with that. The assumption that I think has been made so often, and we don't know the answer to this, is that maybe that this is, he's a hero in a weird vigilante sort of way. Maybe he found out information and he was stopping this monster from continuing and taking the law into his own hands. I tend to wonder, honestly, more the fact that he's been operating with this judge for many years. They are very good friends. They were even family at one point through marriage. That he probably had some inkling of what was going on over here. And if you're the sheriff and you're letting that sort of stuff go on, that's not a good thing. I'm almost wondering if there was, and this is just my conjecture, I'm wondering if he found out something in that deposition based on the questions that were asked that the judge was going to have something on him and that it was going to turn on the sheriff in a very horrible way. And the only thing he can do to stop that is eliminating the judge. That seems to be almost a little more logical in my mind. I know it's more glass half empty, but considering the circumstances, what's your thought?
Yeah, it's certainly a possibility. We can take it in a variety of directions. And it, you know, again, if there was something that he was trying to expose, something horrendous about the judge going on, one would think there were a lot of other options rather than just pulling out the gun and shooting him like that, which, of course, has only ruined his own life as well. So it's weird.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, the insanity comes in or the extreme emotional distress. I mean, that's like, okay, well, I guess if you're facing that and all of your skeletons are coming to light, you might not be in the best mental space, which, you know, maybe I guess could drive someone to that sort of feeling of, you know, like you made the example of the husband walking in on the wife cheating on him. I mean, could that, what would that defense be like? I mean, how would you bring that up into a case like this? If, I mean, because again, you have to assume that then the other parts of the other case are going to be put in here and some of those blanks will be filled in and we don't know if they will. Other than just saying he found out something really horrible and shocking and this is how he reacted.
Yeah, I think that kind of a defense you would be hoping for. Compassion from the jury to obtain a lesser charge and certainly to mitigate in the penalty phase if he were convicted. So it's just to build empathy, that look that could have been any one of us if we heard that kind of disturbing information, that we would react that way.
The fact that he surrendered without resistance right after this happened, he walks out into, you know, the lobby area, puts his gun away to the on the counter, gives it to them, and basically says, arrest me right now. That doesn't sound like an insane person. Or maybe that is completely insane. Maybe he should have run, you know. But it seems fairly calculated.
Yeah. It seems like somebody who's grounded in reality and knows the penalty for what he just did and knows it's wrong, and had a target for whatever his reasons were, had a specific target. He wasn't just out randomly shooting people. So it does not really sound like someone who was so out of their mind that they didn't know what they were doing and didn't know that it was wrong.
The fact that this was a small department, and this is going to be just kind of opinion and conjecture here. This is a very small department. There's only so many people in it. It was a deputy under Steins that the part of the sexual allegations were about was that he was taking people into the judge's chamber. And basically it was, you know, you give me sex and you won't have to be in jail, basically. That was a deputy under him. And part of the argument here was that, well, Mr. Steins, you're above this person. Why didn't you train these people better? How is this going on underneath your nose and watch? It does make me wonder how many other folks in this department may know about this, you know, or be involved in this. And I'm not saying that for sure. I'm not going to say any names because I have no idea. But the fact that this seems to be so kind of out in the open to a certain extent, you're using the judge's chamber. There's got three people here who seem to have some knowledge of this stuff going on. And they're investigating this. There may be some incentive not for the full story to come about because there may be other people implicated in the sex stuff, nothing to do with the murder. And that may be some incentive not to, you know, look in certain holes, I would think. I would think that the investigation on this is going to have to be looked at really with a fine-tooth comb.
Yeah, definitely, because it's hard to imagine that other people were absolutely clueless about it. I agree.
Yeah, it is a mess. We'll see where this all goes.
The world of true crime never stops, and neither do we. Press subscribe now to get daily updates, in-depth analysis, and expert opinions from the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.